Happy Saturday. It's April 13th, 2024, and you are listening to Morning Meeting. I'm Ashley Baker in London.
And I'm Michael Haney in New York City.
And Michael, despite all of the inanity and insanity that has plagued the world this week, we have a great episode of Morning Meeting. But first, in the US, the country was transfixed by the eclipse in London, despite the famous ULEZ regulations that were intended to minimize traffic in the center of town. Unfortunately, a new study shows that congestion has actually risen. More bad news for those of us who are hoping to escape all of this turmoil in the world by relocating somewhere idyllic, like Spain, perhaps. The country announced it's ending its golden visa program, which granted foreigners work and residency permits when they purchased a home or a business worth at least 500,000 euros. Too bad, Michael. We are staying where we are. Airmail is the antidote to all of that, and we've got a great episode of Morning Meeting that will take you right inside this week's supercharged issue.
Absolutely. First, we've got Jack Sullivan, an associate editor here at Airmail, who has a look at St. George, the prep school that made Tucker Carlson who he is today. And then, if you're like a lot of people who might love just about everything about New Orleans, except for the lack of great hotels, you wonder, why is it that nightlife and food and music can be so great, but the hotels so mediocre? Well, as Steve Garbarino reports, several stylish new places have opened, and he'll tell us all about them. And speaking of stylish, it's a dirty little secret that an interior designers so rich and famous are known for knocking off museum-quality furnishings, often with no penalty. Well, no more. And you can thank who else? Kim Kardashian. As our writer Dan Rubenstein will explain, she now finds herself tangled up in a very messy lawsuit with the Donald Judd Foundation over a dining set that she showed on a video and was, or was not, designed by the minimalist artist. So Ashley, where would you like to begin today?
Well, it's been a watershed moment, perhaps, in the world of interior design, as this Donald Judd Foundation lawsuit against Kim Kardashian has made headlines all over the world. Dan Rubenstein, a design journalist and the host of the Grand Tourist podcast, is here to explain exactly what happened and how it could change everything in the world of counterfeit furnishings. Welcome, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
Dan, the world of furniture doesn't often make front page headlines across the globe, but when the Donald Judd Foundation recently sued Kim Kardashian and her interior design firm, Clements Design, everyone started talking about it. So in short, can you explain what happened with the Kardashian kerfuffle?
Yes. A few years ago, Kim Kardashian, for her skin sort of beauty line, she created an office and she hired Clements Design to do it. Once it was completed, she did a beautiful video where she walked through someone on a camera and said, oh, look, here's my Rick Owens benches and there's some artwork by people I've collaborated with. And oh, look at this amazing Donald Judd table in my kitchen. It's so amazing. I'm really into furniture. And then she moves on. The whole thing takes about 10 seconds. But those tables and those chairs were not Donald Judd. They were reproductions made by her interior designers. This is somewhat of a common practice in some ways in the interior design world, especially in the luxury end of the interior design world. Basically, they're now kind of going back and forth about the damages, not so much that they created these tables, but that she promoted it also to her millions of followers, and that video got millions of views. And so, and that's where the case sort of lies. And what's interesting from a design person's perspective is that we don't know whether or not Kim was even aware that they were not Donald Judd tables. We don't know how involved she was with the space and with sourcing all of the individual pieces when it got down to the nitty gritty. Did she just forget? I mean, sometimes you make these decisions on an interior years later, you're actually walking through the completed space. So you could forgive someone from just forgetting that, oh, these aren't actual Donald Judd tables. We were inspired by Donald Judd. You have no idea. And the invoice, when Clements Design produced the invoice to lawyers, it says in the style of Donald Judd, which is parlance in the world of art and design for it's a reproduction, you'd say a knockoff. But the image used, the reference image on the invoice, which they probably thought no one would ever see beyond an accountant, was an actual file photo of a real set of table and chairs by Donald Judd. So the real thing was on the invoice, but in black and white on the invoice, it says this is a reproduction. So that's where a little bit of the waters get even further muddied.
This is so interesting because this sort of thing happens all the time in the world of fashion, right? We see like fast fashion brands knocking off designer stuff, and fashion designs are not often protected by copyright or things like that. But furniture, it seems like it skews more akin to art. And yet this is also an industry in which a lot of the big brand furniture makers are often slightly tweaking these museum quality pieces and reproducing them and selling them to the masses. So how does this all work?
It doesn't really, to be totally honest with you. It's the most complicated part of the design world, aside from things like sustainability and nitty gritty stuff like that when you're talking about architecture and building enormous buildings and what's green and what's not. But really the idea of what is fake, what is a reproduction, what is real, what is not real, is not black and white at all. Because in the world of the super high-end interior design universe, very oftentimes a designer will kind of say, gosh, I need a dining table for my client's kitchen. And they'll say, it would be great if we had a Donald Judd table. Donald Judd tables are very rare and quite expensive. And not only that, let's say they say, someone else says, oh, it's 10 feet long, but really I need it to be 15 feet. But I really love the look. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just draw one up. I'm going to send it to my carpenter. He's going to make it the way that I want it made in whatever size dimension, but it's going to basically be the Donald Judd design, just tweaked to my own pleasure and to the what the client wants. And sometimes that gets miscommunicated. Sometimes a misattributed credit might find itself in a magazine. Sometimes a homeowner might say, well, who made these tables? And someone might say, oh, it's a Donald Judd table. And I think what really bothers people in the design world is not so much that these sort of custom bespoke pieces are made where they're sometimes really referencing either famous pieces or even pieces by living designers sometimes. They don't like living designer knockoffs, where especially if something is already available, but it just kind of gets to the core, this feeling that design is not as respected as fashion. It's not as respected as art. No self-respecting woman who has the budget to have an entire wardrobe of Hermes would just kind of go down Canal Street and buy like a fake Birkin bag. No woman would say, gosh, I really love a Birkin bag, but it would be great if it was like 3 inches wider and I don't want to wait for it because you could take years to have one made. So I'm just going to have someone make one that looks exactly like it and I'll just tell everyone it's an Hermes. That doesn't happen. So people in the design world, and this shouldn't really happen with us either. And it's endlessly complicated.
Well, Dan, I think this is why this Judd Foundation case is so interesting, is because this could potentially be a watershed moment. I mean, it's getting so much attention now internationally. Do you find that the design community is heartened by this development because it may actually lead to some accountability for those who are not especially careful with intellectual property?
I think so. There's an amazing organization called Be Original Americas, and it's an industry group. And I've spoken with the leadership there. And what they're kind of interested in is they have a budget, they have a staff, and they have the most powerful people in design in some cases as part of this industry trade group. I've asked them, like, are you looking to lobby Congress and change laws and things like this? Basically, they were like, no, education is our number one priority. So actually, one of the things that they are doing on the sort of the manufacturing side of things, right? Like, they actually have programs where they educate government officials who were inspectors that work at ports of entry, right? So the people that are inspecting cargo ships filled with looking for fake Birkin bags, they're trying to educate them to how to spot like a Knoll knockoff or like a mid-century chair knockoff or a Barcelona chair knockoff. And so for them, this is really about educating people about design, the value of keeping this intellectual property respected. And so that's really the core of it. This is a teachable moment. Actually, I don't see any evidence to blame Kim, and I don't see any evidence to really blame Clemens Design either way, other than maybe like some design assistant just goofed because they didn't even think, and they put the image of the actual Donald Judd image on the invoice, not thinking that it would get this far. But let's face it, the reason why this whole thing happened is not that it was made and created and purchased. The reason why this whole thing happened, this whole fiasco happened, is that Kim Kardashian, one of the most influential women in America, for good or ill, went on a video and said, these are Donald Judd tables. Let's move on.
I like to think she believed she paid for real Donald Judd tables.
That makes for a juicier story, but we don't know.
Because there's every indication she would. I mean, she collects, she's got the ability to build a collection. And somehow I think it wasn't communicated to her, like, no, we're just making a version of that.
In my reporting, I talked to someone who has spoken with Kim Kardashian about other knockoffs of people in the clan, in the Kardashian clan, that did similar things, but instead of a Donald Judd thing in video, maybe it was a chair and something else. We know that said she's into furniture lately, and she name checks things like Rick Owens, which of course makes people kind of cringe a little bit, because obviously Rick Owens furniture is amazing, but he is known as a fashion designer. So does she respect the Rick Owens and not the Donald Judd kind of thing? But at the end of the day, we know people don't actually blame Kim, it's possible that she just sort of goofed. I mean,
where are we with the lawsuit? I mean, the Judd Foundation, as you report, they wanted her to sort of make a statement and retract this. But she's offered, as you said, to release a video where she sort of acknowledged. But they're going to court, though. They didn't settle this, right? This is not over.
Yeah, they're going back and forth. There was a brief statement that kind of updated the whole situation. It is still sort of up in the air. And obviously, I'm sure that there's multiple parties involved here. And most people that own the rights to these kinds of things, they don't really want to go to court because the laws in the United States are not as strong as, say, in France, according to the people that I've spoken with. It's a little bit, do you really want to take someone to court and drag it out? Or do you really just want to kind of threaten to do that, hopefully get them to create some sort of educational material that has more power than the original video, right? And it's all about image and protecting the reputation of Donald Judd, in my opinion. So obviously that's somewhat easy for Kim to do, but obviously I'm sure her lawyers would disagree and would want to make sure she, for her to endorse anything is a huge deal and quite expensive. So we'll have to see how it all kind of plays out.
And Dan, I think one of the really interesting pieces of this is how, as you mentioned, the fashion industry has done such an incredible job educating consumers about the value of these brands. I mean, if you look at most of the luxury houses now that are throughout Europe and throughout the world, their brand branding is a huge part of the product that they're selling. To a certain extent, the same is true of art as well. People who consider themselves to be collectors would never in a million years have a fake Monet on their walls.
But apparently not, because in some of the sources that we spoke to for the story, they were like, hey, I know people that literally pay to have contemporary living artists knocked off for my LA mansion. And like, that's where it boggles my mind. But and also I have to say, in everyone that I spoke to, everything came back to LA. Not that this couldn't happen in New York or anywhere else, but it kept coming back to Los Angeles. And I can't help but think, is there something about the newly found taste level for art and design in LA that still has one foot trapped in old Hollywood, which is really like, if it looks good on camera, it doesn't matter, right? Like that there is the fundamental disconnect here that maybe, I don't know, something about LA, man. I don't know. If anyone's like a lifelong New Yorker like myself, like I tend to go, aha, it's LA.
Well, Dan, it's such a fascinating story and your perspective is so valuable and your insight into this world of design, which I think is only becoming more and more visible due to the great work of journalists like you that are bringing these issues to light. So thank you so much for sharing it with us.
No, thank you so much. And thank you to Airmail for making it happen.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, guys.
Michael, I know I would never in a million years catch you sitting on a fake Saarinen and chair. You're just not that type of guy.
Absolutely not. I mean, only museum quality Breuer or Arnay or Mies will hold my hindquarters. You know me, I'm a design snob. But speaking of authentic versus fake and what's a replicant or not, Tucker Carlson is also in the news for sort of getting in a big argument with his prep school of all places.
These are the kind of conflicts we live for, Michael. Jack Sullivan, an associate editor here at Airmail, is here to break down the drama happening at St. George's in Rhode Island and how it's at war with one of its previous Golden Star students. Welcome, Jack.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So Tucker Carlson, controversial figure, including, it seems, among his compatriots at his old prep school. So how did St. George's and Tucker Carlson end up back in the news?
Yeah, so student group at St. George's actually approached Tucker Carlson to speak there. There were a certain amount of negotiations over the last few months about how this was going to happen. Was it going to come to campus? Was it going to be on Zoom? The school ended up being a little worried about the possible media attention he could draw, safety concerns, or people from outside the campus going to try to show up. And so they decided it would probably be best to host this over Zoom. And he apparently reluctantly agreed to do so. But they're back in the news because after the Zoom meeting, it became apparent that he had recorded an excerpt of it where he's sort of explaining his side of these negotiations. And that video appeared on Twitter. In it, he kind of ridicules the school to a pretty large extent. And that's sort of how the drama all began.
But Jack, I mean, let's go into that quote unquote. I think it's appropriate when anything that involves Tucker, we use the word drama. Because it seems like, as you report in your story this week, bodyguards involved, there's perhaps controversy on the campus. Wouldn't be surprising that he elevates some of the elements here. So what really was the conflict between the school having it in person and Zoom and vis-a-vis Tucker's reasoning?
Right. Well, according to the school, I mean, Tucker is a huge personality and he's going to attract a lot of interest. So during their discussions, they kind of realized that this was going to have to be quite a big production. The point about security was a big one. The school realized that they would probably want some heightened security measures while they're there. Tucker said that he would feel comfortable, it seems, with armed security. And Rhode Island prohibits having civilians with weapons on campus. So that was kind of out of the question, which Tucker was extremely upset about. Through those kinds of issues, it was sort of realized that there was just no way they were going to be able to host someone of this caliber on campus, and it would have to be done over Zoom. In the school's telling, that was sort of the gist of it. I mean, it's a fairly logical and understandable back and forth between a big media personality and a school that's trying to figure out ways to host the person. But in Tucker's telling, this was far more of a sort of circuitous and vitriolic conversation, wherein the school was coming up with all these different reasons and they couldn't decide on why he couldn't come and were lying to him in his words.
Jack, is there any reason why Tucker Carlson felt he needed armed guards at a prep school? I mean, is he worried someone's going to come after him and try and strangle him with a rep tie or something? This school cost $76,000 a year. It's a seat of the elite. He's an alum. I know the guy likes to pillory the elite, his own class, yet asking for armed guards? Really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it seems a little bizarre that armed guards would be necessary on the shores of Middletown, Rhode Island. But Tucker's telling the school had said that they were nervous about mass unrest, essentially, if he showed up. Now, the school denies this. Whether or not anything like that was actually said is unclear. But I think Tucker feels as though his presence demands some level of security and heightened measures to quell any unrest for whatever reason that might be.
Then his response, how much of this is sour grapes on his half? I mean, we're a guy who loves the school. And by the way, let's also say he is of the elite. He's an heir to the Swanson frozen food fortune. So he sort of like gets a little, I'm going to take my ball and go home because you won't allow me to come back to my school and address these people.
Yeah, I mean, so you watch the video and he sort of assaults the school for censoring free speech and all these sort of try to put a damper on him, essentially. And you come to realize that considering the fact that he did actually speak over Zoom and the meeting was held, the real thing that he seems to be upset about is the fact that he's not being treated by the school as some amazing alumni who they need to roll out the red carpet for. You do definitely get the sense that he's frustrated over some kind of character defamation. And that's why he's released this video. And that's why he's criticizing the school to this extent. I mean, at the end of the day, it's again, quite logical that a celebrity of his stature, political affiliations aside, might be difficult for campus to host. And that's not necessarily an insult to someone, but he definitely takes it as such.
Jack, do you think ultimately this is a good or a bad look for St. George? In terms of its core constituency, how do you think that the world is seeing this conflict versus the school and its insular little world?
I think there's definitely a Streisand effect element to it, because if this had never become a big news story again, it's very logical of them to not want or be able to host someone like Tucker Carlson on campus, especially on short notice. But I think now that all this stuff has come out, you're going to have Tucker Carlson supporters upset at the school and saying that, oh, they're indoctrinated and they're not allowing free speech on campus. And Tucker says these kinds of things in his sort of rant against the school. He's saying they're forcing ideology down the student's throat. These kinds of seemingly baseless claims just based on the fact that he wasn't allowed to speak there. But then on the other side, I think people in general, hopefully, in understanding the details of the story, will realize that it's hard to say that the school is at some kind of fault here, has a real vendetta against Carlson, especially since he spoke at the school as recently as 2015.
Yeah, I think what's just as you wisely sum up in your reporting this week, I mean, Tucker in his rant says it's just a place where ideology is forced down your throat, not allowing you to disagree. And yet he was allowed to speak at campus, I mean, virtually on Zoom. So shocker. Tucker is going to present it his way to get the most sizzle out of it.
But what I also find so fascinating about this is Tucker Carlson already has a huge platform. Like, it seems like he's taking this incredibly personally because, once again, it all goes back to high school, right? I mean, he feels like he's being slighted by an institution that clearly means a lot to him, because otherwise, why would he care? I mean, this is a guy who wages battles on social media and in the press almost every day.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, really, it just seems like another opportunity for him to sort of express the things that he likes to talk about the most, right? I mean, to turn this into a huge issue of politics, it seems a little far-fetched. Again, he says right at the start of his video, why wouldn't they allow me on campus? It's because of my politics. This is a place that he's spoken at, has sent his kids to, married his wife on the campus of. I think he has a good sense of, well, I would be surprised if he felt as though their politics were so inverse to his that all of a sudden in 2024, they banned him from campus. It seems a little out of the question.
You mentioned his wife, and let's remind people, she is the daughter of the former headmaster. So I also just would love to picture that conversation at home. Like, my father never would have allowed this to happen, but maybe it's a little easier to go after St. George and create a little dumpster fire over there when people are still criticizing you for bootlicking Vladimir Putin. So it's a way to distract people from the noise that you don't want them to pay attention to.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Well, Jack, fascinating story. We always love talking smack about Tucker Carlson. I'm sorry to say. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great, Jack. Thank you so much. That was great. Well, if Tucker's tantrum just makes you want to get away from it all, might we suggest New Orleans? For years, there's been one problem with the Big Easy, however. It has not been easy to find a cool hotel. But as Steve Gabarino reports, all that has changed.
Steve Gabarino, former editor of Black Book magazine, here to tell us all about the exciting hotel developments in his hometown. In short, there's never been a better time to visit. Welcome, Steve.
Hi.
First of all, it's a busy moment in New Orleans where you live. What's going on there right now?
For starters, it's definitely the best time of year you could ever be here, but for maybe late October, like Halloween zone, because everything's blooming. It's beautiful. There's a real energy to it when you're just smelling night blooming jasmine and orange blossoms. And in a nutshell, it's just a time when more people are out and about, and there is that kind of electricity in the air for April being one of the non-cruelest of months. Once Jazz Fest, the second week of Jazz Fest goes through, everyone kind of jokingly says, enjoy it for summer is coming. Because then we were like, last year we had record temperatures like all through the long summer. So this is a really great time to be here. And it begins with the French Quarter Festival, which has just grown enormously. I mentioned the piece that it was way more people than I even realized. Last year was a record breaker of 40 years that that's existed. And then Jazz Fest is going to be a big deal this year, not just because the Rolling Stones are headlining in the second week, but also Neil Young and Crazy Horse are playing and the Foo Fighters are going to play with them. That's fun stuff. But you mainly go there for all the regional food that's delicious. And it is fun that there's people, there's a lot more hotels that aren't just going to be Hiltons and Sheratons and things like that, that people can really embrace the character on the days that they're not at Jazz Fest and whatnot, and just like be a part of the city a little bit.
So Steve, New Orleans hotels were famously not especially exciting. I mean, as you report in your piece, there's so much to do and see in this town. Great restaurants, great bars, great cultural activities, but the hotels never seem to live up to the rest of the city. So what's changed?
The hotels, it's often the people that seem to really embrace the old in the city and all these places that are mentioned in the story. It's so rare that a city would have like an old orphanage or an old convent or an old fire station or all these things. And for one reason or other, and it's not dissing locals, but it often seems that people that have come here from elsewhere seem to embrace the architecture. Because you go around this town, and I'm constantly doing real estate porn with my, just going, wish I could buy that building or that overhang that goes across the Algiers Point. And it sometimes takes someone that has a refreshed viewpoint of it. I think the city is so rich and fascinating that often the locals just take it for granted. And so I think that one of the reasons this is happening is it's just things take a long time to happen here, to change, and their preservation rules are almost sometimes a little too draconian. I mean, I've had friends try to open a Cafe Habana outpost here, and it took them 10 years to simply get them to approve what was an abandoned gas station that was not a lovely place. It's definitely a traditional town steeped in ritual. It's hard for it to happen. And I think it's mainly because a lot of people come here for the gambling casinos like Harris Casino, and all they really are looking for is a room to stay in. What's happened is travelers, as you both know, are just a lot more erudite and are seeking things that are just off the path a little bit more. It's not just like wanting to get a hotel room to get drunk in and just go down to Bourbon Street. It's definitely a more sophisticated traveler coming to New Orleans. And I think it's responding to that because these hotels are almost all sold out way in advance. These smaller, from 10 rooms to 40, there's definitely an attraction to be a part of the city a little bit more.
So, Steve, tell us about the Celestine. A lot of people are talking about that.
Well, it's funny because that's a perfect example of the quarter kind of like New Orleans taking back its own city in a way, because this is just barely off of Bourbon Street on Toulouse Street, maybe a block from there. And you would never really want to stay in any of the places that would be in that area. Not really. And so for them to be able to open this structure that's like goes back to so much of the quarter and the Faubourg Marin, it goes back to like mid-1700s. For them to put that there, it's sort of like this wonderful, it's an escape hatch from, some people are going to want to be out on the front porch. You can either face the back of the courtyard, which is this beautiful courtyard that Tennessee Williams did actually write a good deal of Streetcar Named Desire and like to hang out there back in the 40s. You can be on the front and hear and see all of Bourbon Street and all that. And there's a lot that's good about that. I mean, it is ribald and fun, but the other side is all tranquil and beautiful, old courthouses. And the rooms are just so, it is such a small place. They're going to be adding two, there's two servants' quarters in the back that they're going to be adding to the 10 rooms. But it just has this really beautiful tranquility and splashes of color. There's even like on the third floor, there's like a children's room that for some reason people are digging bunk beds lately in New Orleans. But there's this like vibe of a playfulness to the space. And Sarah Casello, she did the Chloe Hotel also that's closer to me. I live uptown and closer to the Garden District. And it's another pretty spectacular space. And they just kind of, she's one of those transplants that has very good taste, but she also gets the whimsy and the elegance of the city and the kind of shabby chicness of it all. The Celestine is, I've just visited a couple of times and was just immediately impressed. And the owners own a cool bar next door called The Will and the Way. That's going to be doing most of their food. So there's a nice little crisscross in that.
So Steve, for someone looking for ultimate nightlife who wants to be in the center of the bars and all of that action, what would you recommend?
More than anywhere, uptown New Orleans. There's downtown and uptown. And downtown is the French Quarter. It's Faubourg Marin. It's what was the once more, I hate the word, but like hip spot, which is the Bywater, because Hollywood was making so much movies and many movies there. And uptown is where it's a great high-low culture, meaning that there's still the 24/7 bars. And then there's also some of the greatest like secret little restaurants and famous restaurants like Commander's Palace and whatnot. But for live music, the whole city is sort of, it's evolved quite a bit because going towards uptown, mid-city is now like one of the big areas. And it's always had bars like live music clubs like the Maple Leaf Bar. These things don't change. And then, but downtown, there's a lot more alternative music bands and alternative music places. That's a strip club called St. Claude that heads towards Bywater. And that's a really good area with Saturn Bar and the Always Lounge and the high-low.
You mentioned preservation. It's always funny to me. You go into that city and the first thing you see on your way in from the airport is the Superdome looming there like a gigantic goiter on the skyline. And then you get into all the old places. And I'm just intrigued. You said there have been a couple of new places built like the Henrietta. Are these new places just as good and cool as the old restored places?
Yeah, here's the thing. It's like you've got the inn at the old jail, but then last year you had the World Trade Center, not, of course, New York. Here is abandoned building forever, this tower with a revolving rooftop bar long ago. That's now a Four Seasons. That's a great addition to the city. It's a big beacon. I mean, you see it from afar and it's right on the riverfront. And yet at the same time, then you've got this little former jailhouse. It's actually rather beautiful in a neighborhood that maybe 5 years ago, people probably wouldn't have ventured to, even though Treme is like the home of jazz, really, more than anything, that in the Storyville area. So, I mean, that's an example of like when I was doing the story, I wanted to kind of traverse the parts of town, not just be in the quarter or uptown. This seems to be an ongoing thing because I know of other situations where buildings are being constructed and that from the ground up one, it was, I mean, for a long time, we always were like, there's this great restaurant next door called the Jelly Chase, French restaurant and big outdoor area. And it's just very lively. Well, that always had this building that was considered either, it was part massage parlor and part whatever comes along with massage parlors, and that was knocked down. So in a way, that ground still does fit into that sort of like these kind of public institutional places being turned into rather glamorous hotels and guest houses and whatnot.
Well, Steve, it sounds like Michael and I need to get to New Orleans immediately because there are too many cool things to do and too many great places to stay. So thank you so much for your story and for sharing it all with us here.
Good to see you, Steve. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Steve. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Okay. Bye.
There's only one place to discover a global snapshot of the current cultural scene. AirMail's Arts Intel Report, our international research tool for what to do and where and when to do it, is user-friendly, continuously updated, and meticulously curated. Arts Intel is handy at home, on the road, and when you're planning your next trip. It also includes indispensable lists of restaurants and hotels in key cities around the world, recommended by our well-traveled experts. Explore Arts Intel at airmail.news/arts-intel And be sure to sign up for our Week in Culture newsletter, which is published every Wednesday afternoon at airmail.news/WIC. I'm Chris Garrett, Airmail Deputy Editor, and I never leave home without it. Bon voyage.
Michael, when's the last time that you went to New Orleans?
I think I was there pre-COVID. I know I was there, yeah. I'm happy to hear this because, I mean, to me, the Big Easy has been the big difficult. So I've never really enjoyed going there just because for this very reason. It's like not a fun place to stay outside of the Collins Hotel, which I did enjoy once. How about you?
I haven't been there in about 10 years, but actually maybe a bit longer than that, maybe 11 or 12. But it's a fun town. And Steve is tempting me. What can I say? But there are a lot of great places to see in the world and a lot of great things to do this weekend. So, Michael, please, I know you've got something you can recommend.
I do. Have you seen the new version of The Talented Mr. Ripley that's out on Netflix right now?
No, but I've been dying to see it. So please give me the full story.
So for those of you who haven't seen it, as I said, it's on Netflix. It stars Andrew Scott as Tom Ripley, and it's adapted by this screenwriter, Steve Zaillian, who also wrote Gangs of New York and a bunch of other things that you love. And it's got a lot going for it, beginning strangely with the fact, I thought at first, that it's shot in black and white for something that's shot on the Amalfi Coast and to Italy. You want to see all those colors. But instead, it creates this very haunting, I think it's a very smart creative choice to do it. Shot over, I think, 8 episodes, which kind of, you think, oh, it's going to be too long. But also, I think that languorous pace kind of draws you in and lets the grift unfold. So I'm a couple episodes in. I'm intrigued by it. But I would suggest, if you're here in New York, I would highly encourage you to go to Film Forum. I know, Ashley, it's one of your favorite places, where you can do a compare and contrast of adaptations, as the theater is currently showing Purple Noon, the René Clément adaptation of the Patricia Highsmith book that stars Alain Delon, and that's my favorite. So if you're in New York, you can do the 1-2 punch, but if not, it's The Talented Mr. Ripley, which is on Netflix now. And you, my dear? How about you?
Well, I just read a wonderful new novel. It's called 2 Hours by Alba Arica. This is her third novel. She's a French-born writer and musician. And this one is all about the two families that she's inhabited in her life. The first that she was born into, and the second that she created for herself as a young woman. And it's fascinating. The crux of it is this 2-hour meeting that she had as a 16-year-old with this guy named Alexander that she fell in love with. And that informs the next 40 years of her life, really. And it's totally fascinating and beautifully written. It's a slim little book that I just tore through, and I really, it sort of reads like autofiction, which is a genre that I love and hate and love to hate, but it's really well done. Her prose is wonderful, and the way that she writes about relationships I found to be really moving and sensitive. So it's a new novel. It's called 2 Hours by Alba Arica, and it was published by Eris in March. Okay. Well, we want to thank you all so much for joining us. We wish you a wonderful weekend. Michael, will you please read us out?
With pleasure. Morning Meeting is produced by Airplay Productions and edited by Jesse Cannon. Our co-editors are Graydon Carter and Alexander Stanley. Our chief operating officer is Bill Keenan, and our deputy editors are Ashley Baker, Chris Garrett, Nathan King, Julie Vitale, and Ash Carter. Our CMO is Emily Davis, and our music supervisor is Randall Poster. Our theme music is The Cute Monster by the Buddy Colette Quintet. A new edition of Airmail is published every Saturday, so please subscribe and enjoy all of our stories on airmail.news, which we update every day. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at Airmail Weekly. We will be back here next Saturday with another edition of Morning Meeting, but in the meantime, be sure to subscribe at Spotify or Apple Music. But most of all, thank you again for joining us.